Pastor Rod has asked me to introduce the speaker, and by way of introducing the speaker and in light of Evolution Sunday, there are always evolutions going on around us, and I know a woman by the name of Ava Goldman, and I had her in mind when I saw that we were having an insect zoo, but I thought, wait a minute. I can't picture it. So this morning, as I came in, I discovered that Aviva is not Ava, and also that Aviva is the daughter of a woman and family that I worked with very closely when I was on the city council. So evolution comes around. She said I didn't look any different, and Tamar, you don't either. So we're good and healthy, and it's looking good. But it is my pleasure today to introduce Aviva Goldman, who is a PhD candidate in the entomology department at UC Riverside, who grew up in Costa Mesa, attended preschool here at Fairview Community Church, and I don't know if it was when we were actually running the preschool, or if it had already been leased out to someone, we don't know. But she has vague but positive memories of her time here. Just like I have vague and positive memories of many things. She was introduced to entomology in the third grade by Mrs. Farmer at College Park Elementary School, who let her stay in the classroom and watch silkworms for hours after school. What a wonderful story of our school systems. After several years of studying vertebrae and plants in college, Aviva took her first entomology class and decided to pursue a career in the field. Currently, she is studying predatory insects and spiders that attack the Asian citrid psyllid. And Rebecca knows, has been talking to me all about the Asian citrid psyllid because she's a master gardener. And it's a serious insect that vectors a deadly pathogen of citrus trees. So killing off the citrus trees, and yet we have these insects and spiders that attack them. I think that's good, right? Okay. If I follow the line right. She loves science outreach and wants to work in agricultural extension or mosquito and vector control. When not writing her dissertation, teaching, or applying for jobs, she is asleep. So we welcome you and are anxious to hear all about insects and bugs that do good work for us. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me here today. It's great to be back after about 30 years. the church was the preschool at least, was very welcoming to me, and they were happy to serve the only Jewish kid in class just green eggs instead of green eggs and ham like everybody else. You didn't think I remembered that, Mom and Dad, did you? I just want to say that I'm not here representing UC Riverside or the entomology department or my other classmates who are here today or science in general or the Jewish people. My opinions are my own. I take full responsibility. I love that we're celebrating Evolution Sunday because I'm an entomologist, and evolution is the key central concept in all of biology and life on Earth. So a very famous evolutionary biologist named Dobzhansky famously said that nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution. So if you're celebrating life on Earth, you're celebrating evolution and vice versa. You're also celebrating science and discovery and the ability of human beings to move closer to understanding the universe. I'm going to talk about why I think celebrating and studying biodiversity is an important devotional act. I would even call it a mitzvah for people of the Abrahamic traditions. And I want to try to share a sense of wonder at how vast the world of life on Earth is by introducing you to one of my favorite groups of insects, the parasitic wasps, which I mentioned earlier during kids' time. Next slide, please. So please understand that when I refer to Genesis, I take it as a spiritual and moral account of my people's history, and not as a science textbook, of course, or even a history textbook. In the traditions where I grew up, conservative and now reformed Judaism, at least in the congregations I belong to, it's taught that it's our job to find the meaning and relevance for today in each verse and even in each Hebrew letter, rather than try to struggle to make the literal translation match what our scientific investigations tell us. So I think it's interesting that our ancestors understood certain things. They understood that the world came to be in stages, that light and dark came before the oceans and atmosphere, and that the oceans and atmosphere came before plants. Of course, after plants were created is when the sun and moon were created, which is not impossible in a literal sense, but there's a lot of writing about the metaphorical meaning of light and dark being created twice. After plants came animals, and after animals came human beings, and that's where we came into the story, as Pastor Rod recounted for us earlier. Next slide, please. Immediately after the creation of man, God starts telling Adam what to do. So in Hebrew, Adam means either Adam, the first human, or it means Adam, all of humankind. So I feel like what God tells Adam first is important and we should pay attention. So what was the first command? To be fertile and increase and rule the earth. So I think we can check that one off the list. Next slide, please. The second commandment was not to eat from the tree of knowledge. How'd that go? I think that ship has sailed. And the third one? The third commandment was to name all the animals. How's that going? Are we done yet? My classmate Judith just discovered two new species of wasps. She named one after her husband and another one after Ani DeFranco. So now are we done naming all the animals? So how many are on Earth anyway? Next slide, please. One of the recent estimates is that there might be a trillion species on Earth, counting microbes. I know God said animals, but in the Jewish tradition called building a fence around the Torah, I think it's just to be on the safe side. Let's say God meant plants, fungi, microbes, and everything else as well. Next slide, please. Biodiversity means biological diversity. The word was invented in the 80s by a man named E.O. Wilson, who is one of the most famous entomologists of all time, next to Charles Darwin, Vladimir Nabokov, and Tom Hanks's brother, Dr. Hanks. Yeah. Biodiversity means the variety of all forms of life, from genes to species, through to the broad scale of ecosystems. And there's so much work to be done to explore all of that and catalog it, and so few people are doing it. Next slide, please. The people who are doing it, like my classmate Judith, who I mentioned, are called taxonomists and systematists. Taxonomy means classifying and naming, and systematics or phylogenetics means grouping species according to their evolutionary relationships. Next slide, please. So remember, it was an entomologist, E.O. Wilson, who came up with the word biodiversity. I think entomologists are in a great position to, compared to other kinds of biologists, to really start to feel a sense of the diversity of life on Earth. And here's why. Because you may have seen a drawing like this before. Each plant or animal represents the number of species in that group that are known. So the bigger the animal, the more we know from its group. There's a picture of a tiny elk on there that represents all the species of mammals in the world. So everything that is covered in hair and feeds milk to its offspring is represented by that tiny elk. And then, about 20 times bigger is a picture of a wasp, which represents the number of species of insects. Next slide, please. There are over a million described species of insects already, and I think we've got less than half at this point. They represent probably at least 60% of all advanced life forms on Earth, meaning not counting microbes this time. So you might be wondering where all this biodiversity comes from. Why do we have so many species? Next slide, please. There are a lot of ways that new species come about, and one of my favorite ways that new biodiversity comes about is called a novel feature. So sometimes in evolutionary history, some species develops a new kind of body part or ability that makes it wildly successful and able to split off a lot of new ancestors into a lot of new species. So this is a family history of the insects, simplified. And for insects, the key innovation was definitely wings. So wings evolved, I know it's small, but wings evolved at the bottom, right above the two bottom branches of insects, about 350 million years ago. And if you look at the numbers of insects below when they developed wings and then after they developed wings, it's an astonishing difference. I know in Costa Mesa we have silverfish. Silverfish are one of the most primitive branches of insects. I mean, they've been evolving for the same amount of time, but they're closer to the common ancestor of all insects in terms of body shape. There are 675 species of diplurans, which is what silverfish are. Now compare that to 300,000 species of beetles, 100,000 species of wasps that are known, that are described, 5,000 species of dragonflies. So ants, wasps, and bees, which I'm going to talk about, are the third largest group of insects or order of insects. And they, like all the other groups, have even their own novel features that helped them develop another explosion in diversity. Next slide, please. They're called the Hymenoptera, which means wings made of membrane because their wings are thin and transparent. So I talked about yellow jackets already, and you know about bees and how they're pollinators. There's an incredible amount of natural history there, but I'm going to talk about the biggest and to me the most incredible group of wasps, which is called the parasitoids. And I have spent over half my career as an entomologist working on parasitic wasps. They're all around us, and most of them are so small you wouldn't even notice if they landed on your eyeglasses or sunglasses. Next slide, please. The stingers that you're familiar with on wasps and bees are a modified version of an earlier structure called the ovipositor. The ovipositor is an egg depositor that females have. It's a long tube that they use to put their eggs where they need to go. The earliest wasps used their ovipositors to lay eggs in plants. But a novel feature was the ability to start to lay eggs in other insects. So the tiny wasp in the upper right picture is laying her egg in another insect's egg. That's how small she is. And when her egg hatches, her larva will eat the contents of that other insect's egg and then pupate, go into its cocoon inside of it, and then emerge as an adult ready to mate and start the life cycle over again. Next slide, please. Wasps that do this are called parasitoids. So they lay their eggs not just in another insect's egg, but maybe in another insect or spider. And when the eggs hatch, the larvae eat the host either from the inside or from the outside. So usually this is a very specialized relationship between the host insect and the parasitoid wasp. The wasp can only attack its host species or some very closely related species. The larva might pupate inside the host and then emerge through a hole in the top, leaving a shell that we call a mummy. So if we put this in human terms, this is the movie Alien in real life. And it may seem gruesome, But let's talk about some of these relationships and what they mean to ecosystems. A lot of these wasps attack insects that to humans are pests. If you've grown tomatoes, you know about tomato hornworms. They're not your best friend. So that huge green caterpillar in the upper right is being attacked by dozens of Cotesia wasps, tiny wasps, which bring with them a virus that changes the caterpillar's internal anatomy to make it more of a hospitable host to the wasp's development. And that caterpillar is not going to be able to complete its development because of the infestation. Cockroaches in the upper left are attacked by these beautiful emerald green wasps called Ampulex, which sting the cockroach in its nerve center and partially paralyze it so that it can be marched back to the wasps, where the wasp has its offspring, so that they can feed on the cockroach. Sometimes we bring in wasps like this because we need their help to control a pest. This wasp in the lower left-hand corner is called Trioxys pallidus, and it was brought here to help control walnut aphid. And because of it, farmers in California were able to grow walnuts without spraying their trees for aphids with pesticides for decades. The biggest success story, though, in my opinion, is the beautiful wasp on the lower right-hand side called Apoanagyrus lopezi, and it helped save large parts of Africa from famine when there was a terrible outbreak of cassava mealybug. And cassava mealybug was not able to be controlled by other means, and when this parasitoid was brought in, it was able to control the population to the point where cassava mealybug was no longer causing starvation. So she, Apoanagyrus lopezi, next slide please, is part of a truly wonderful group, and we're getting into even smaller groups now, called the Chalcedoidea, but there are still 25,000 known species of this group of wasps, and the professor who gave me this slide thinks that there are up to 500,000, like my classmate Judith is discovering. So they have a huge range of biodiversity, maybe more than any other insect group, and they attack thousands of different insects, and as well as spiders, ticks, mites, and even nematodes. So one of the wasps, the one in the upper left-hand corner that you probably can't even see, hitches a ride on the back of dragonflies in order to parasitize its eggs in the water. And the one below it, with the very strange shape, parasitizes ants. Ants are really good at not being attacked, but this one family of wasps has figured out how to do it. The wasps lay their eggs on plants, and when the eggs hatch, the larvae grab a hold of the right species of ant when they come by foraging. Then they hitch a ride back to the ant's nest and start parasitizing their larvae. After they pupate and emerge as adults, the ants don't notice them because they smell just the same as the ants. And then, you can't quite see it here, but I've got some specimens in the boxes. A lot of them have these kind of tuning fork-looking structures sticking out of their backs that the ants use to just pick them up and carry them outside the nest safely so that they can continue their life cycle. Agaonidae, the fig wasps, are in the middle right. That was a picture of a male, and it miraculously changed to a female overnight. I don't understand it, but they're not parasitoids. They are absolutely necessary to pollinate figs and ficus trees. No fig wasps, no ficus. And at the bottom, the red chalcid wasp parasitizes antlions, those scary larvae that live in tiny pits in the sand and trap ants for dinner, that I believe that sand pit monster in Star Wars was based after. Next slide, please. Oh, wait, go back. Yeah, okay. You see, as she changes the slides, you can see the male fig wasp. Can you do that again? Yeah, that's the male fig wasp. They're specialized to live their entire life inside the fruit. So they have no wings, and they almost have no eyes, and they have very large limbs to fight with each other. All right, next slide, please, the one with the coin. Thank you. My classmate, Ryan Perry, he's another systematist, took this photo. These are all wasps from the Chalcedoids, and he found all of them in one trap in Peru. Next slide, please. And of course, that's a dime. So that's actual size. And the smallest one is about a tenth of the size of the biggest one. Next slide, please. There are seven families of flies represented on this coin. Flies, wasps, what am I thinking? Next slide, please. The smallest ones can only be seen with a microscope. They're called fairy flies from my Merid family. Next slide. And I even have a hard time believing it, but there are amoebas that are bigger than some of these wasps. Next slide, please. So how many of them can we expect to find out there? Well, a colleague of one of my professors reported that in a 75-meter area, which is about the wingspan of a 747 jet, in 6 hours, he collected over 9,400 wasps, and they represented almost 800 different species. And I don't know how many of them were new species, and this is in Costa Rica, but I guarantee there were a lot. So next slide, please. So multiply that kind of experience by the entire Earth, with its millions of species. Each one has its own completely unique universe of causes and conditions that made it be that way, and molecules, and its evolutionary history, and its own natural history, and bacteria living in its guts that change the way it behaves, and the chemicals it produces, and tricks pulled by its DNA. And it gives me a feeling of wonder that just dipping our toes into the surface of life on Earth to this degree shows us this kind of natural diversity and wonder. And I think it's far too much for any of us to hold in our minds at once, and so it's the work of generations. And and when we were told to name all the animals, I don't think that God thought that Adam would get it done in those first few weeks in the Garden of Eden. Next slide, please. There's a Hebrew blessing for seeing large wonders of nature, but there's also one for seeing small wonders of nature. I think that it's important we often hear about people who want to use religion to inform science and science's conclusions and how science is done. But I think that also science can inform our relationship to religion. And I think Charles Darwin was touching on this when he ended The Origin of Species by saying, "There is grandeur in this view of life with its several powers, having been originally breathed into a few forms or into one, and that while this planet has gone cycling on according to the fixed law of gravity, from so simple a beginning, endless forms most beautiful and most wonderful have been and are being evolved." Thank you very much.
Let's give Aviva a rousing hand. You were incredible.
Thank you.
And I gotta tell you, I'm never gonna.